Hello, and welcome to another edition of Maplewood Bar and Radio Theater, brought to you in conjunction with KBIA. Tonight, we return to the early 20th century with a few stories from one of our favorite authors, O. Henry. In his book, The Gentle Grafter, Andy Tucker and Jeff Peters are accomplished con men in the Old West. While they usually work well with each other in their swindles and are bosom buddies, Andy and Jeff are often at odds over just how far to take a defraudulation, as O. Henry might put it. Jeff Peters was always eloquent when the ethics of his profession was under discussion, as shown in the following story, Shearing the Wolf.
The only times that me and Andy Tucker ever had any hiatuses in our cordial relationship was when we differed on the moral aspects of grafting. Andy had his standards and I had mine. I didn't approve of all of Andy's schemes for levying contributions from the public, and he thought I allowed my conscience to interfere too often for the financial good of the firm. We had high arguments sometimes. This one summer, me and Andy decided to rest up a spell in a fine little town in the mountains of Kentucky called Grassdale. We were supposed to be horse drovers and good, decent citizens. The Grassdale people liked us, and one day the leading hardware merchant of Grassdale drops around to the hotel where me and Andy was staying. We knew him pretty well from pitching pennies in the courthouse. After we talked for a spell, this fellow, Murkison, for such was his name, takes a letter out of his coat pocket in a careful, careless way and hands it to us to read.
Now, what do you think of that? Somebody sending a letter like that to me.
Let me see here. It says you can invest $1,000 in cash and you get $5,000 in bills that an expert couldn't tell from the genuine article. What do you make of it, Andy?
Well, it says that they are made from plates stolen by an employee of the Treasury at Washington.
Well, think of them sending a letter like that to me.
Lots of good men get them. If you don't answer the first letter, they let you drop. If you answer it, they write you again asking you to come on with your money and do business.
A few days later, he dropped around again.
Boys, I know you are all right or I wouldn't confide in you. I wrote to them rascals again, just for fun. They answered me and told me to come on to Chicago and see a Mr. J. Smith. When I get there, I'm to wait on a certain street corner till a man in a gray suit comes along and drops a newspaper in front of me. Then I'm to ask him how the water is, and then he knows it's me and I know it's him.
Ah, yes. It's the same old game. I've often read about it in the papers. Then he conducts you to the private abattoir in the hotel where Mr. Jones is already waiting. They show you brand new real money and sell you all you want at 5 for 1. You see him put it in a satchel for you and know it's there. Of course, it's a brown paper bag when you come to look at it afterward.
Oh, they couldn't switch it on me. I haven't built up the best paying business in Grassdale without having witticisms about me. You say it's real money they show you, Mr. Tucker.
I've read in the papers that it always is.
But boys, I don't think them fellas can fool me. I think I'll put a couple of thousand in my jeans and go up there and put it all over them. If they offer me $5 for one, they'll have to stick to the bargain if they take on me. That's the kind of trader Bill Murkison is. Yes, I'll just believe I'll drop up Chicago way and take a 5-to-1 shot on that J. Smith.
Me and Andy tries to get this financial misquotation out of Murkison's head, but no, sir. He was bound and determined to perform a public duty by catching these swindlers at their own game. It would teach them a lesson. After Murkison left, Andy sat a while prepondering over the situation. Finally, he says,
Jeff, seldom have I seen fit to impugn your molars when you are ragging me about your conscientious way of doing business. I may have been often wrong, but here is a case where I think we can agree. I feel that it would be wrong for us to allow Mr. Murkison to go alone to meet those Chicago counterfeiters. It can only come out one way. Don't you think we should intervene in some way to stop him from losing his money?
Andy, I was just thinking the same thing. It would not be honorable or praiseworthy for us to let Murchison go on with this project. If he's determined to go, let us go with him and prevent this swindle from coming off.
Yep. We need to break up this counterfeiting scheme.
Well, we went to see Murchison.
Why, I'd be plumb diverted to death to have y'all come along with me. Maybe you could help some when it comes to cashing in the ticket to that 5-to-1 shot. Yes, I'd really take it as a pastime and a regalement if you boys would come along as well.
Murchison wires Jay Smith that he will set foot in the spider web on a given date, and the three of us lights out for Chicago. We got there about 7 p.m. Murchison was to meet the gray man at 9:30. We had dinner at a hotel and then went up to Murchison's room to wait for the time to come.
Now, boys, let's get our gumption together and inoculate a plan for defeating the enemy. Suppose when I meet the man in the gray suit, you two come along by accident, you know, and holler, "Hello, Mark," and we'll shake hands and act surprised. Then I'll take the capper aside and tell him that y'all are Jenkins and Brown of Grassdale, groceries and feed, good men, and maybe willing to take a chance. Now, how does that scheme strike you?
What do you say, Jeff?
Well, I'll tell you what I say. I say let's settle this thing right here and now. I don't see any use wasting any more time. See this nickel-plated 38, you undevout, sinful, insidious hog? Get out that 2000 and lay it on the table, now!
All right. Here it is.
Such men as you is what keeps the jails and courthouses going. You come up here to rob these men of their money. Does it excuse you that they were trying to rob you? No, sir. You was going to fleece Peter to stave off Paul. You are 10 times worse than any counterfeiter. You go to church at home and pretend to be a decent citizen, but you'll come to Chicago and commit larceny from men who have built up a sound and profitable business by dealing with such contemptible scoundrels as you. How do you know that that poor counterfeiter hasn't got a large family dependent on his extortions? Counterfeiting is hard work, and this man has probably studied for years to learn his trade. And you come up here all sanctified and pompified with respectability just to swindle him. Mr. Tucker and me seized you up and come along with you so that you got what you deserved. Now, we'll take the money, you hypocrite, to keep you from stealing.
Are you sure about this, Jeff?
Yes, yes. Just pick up the money and put it in your pocket. That's it. Now you, get out your watch.
What, you're going to steal my watch too?
No, I don't want it. Lay it on the table and you just sit in that chair till it ticks off an hour. Then you can go. If you make any noise before that, we'll have the whole thing in the Grassdale paper next week.
Jeff, are you sure?
Then me and Andy left. On the train, Andy was silent a long time. Then he says,
Jeff, do you mind me asking you a question?
Sure. Go ahead.
Was that the idea you had when we started out with Murchison?
Why, certainly. What else could it have been? Wasn't it yours, too? In about a half an hour, Andy spoke again. I think there are times when Andy don't exactly understand my system of ethics and moral hygiene.
Jeff, sometime when you have the leisure, I wish you'd draw a diagram with footnotes of that conscience of yours. I'd like to refer to it occasionally.
Andy never did understand my high ethics and morals when it came to swindling. We left poor old Murchison high and dry. But fleecing people is a hard business, so shortly after our Chicago adventure, Andy and me decides we need a vacation. We needed a rest from our professional and business duties, but it seemed like our work followed us wherever we went. That's how we got involved in A Midsummer Masquerade at the Woodchuck Inn. We was tired of financing and all those branches of unsanctified ingenuity. Even Andy, whose brain rarely ever stopped working, was worn out. So we gathered a bunch of summer resort literature and took a week to study out where we should go. When we finished the booklets, me and Andy packed our trunks and took the 6 o'clock train to Crow Knob, where there was a resort, kind of a last resort, you might say, in the mountains on the border of Tennessee and North Carolina. We was directed to a kind of private hotel called the Woodchuck Inn. The inn set back from the road in a big grove of trees, and it looked fine with its broad porches and a lot of women in white dresses rocking in the shade. Well, sir, when we got to the gate, who do you suppose comes down the walk to greet us? Old Smoke-em-out Smithers, who used to be the best painless dentist and electric liver pad faker in the Southwest. Old Smoke-em-out has the mingled air of a landlord and a claim jumper.
Gents, am I glad to see you. I'm the host and perpetrator of the Woodchuck Inn.
Good to see you, Smoke-em-out. This here's my partner, Andy Tucker. You can trust him. He's in the trade.
Howdy, Mr. Smoke-em-out.
Well, nice to meet you, Andy. Gents, I'm mighty glad to see you. Maybe you could help me out of a scrape. I'm getting a bit old for street work, so I leased this Dog Days Emporium so the good things would come to me. 2 weeks before season opened, I gets a letter signed Lieutenant Peary and one from the Duke of Marlborough, each wanting to board here for the summer.
Sounds like some famous people.
Oh, they are. You know what a big thing it is for an obscure hustlery like this to have a couple of famous guests like that. So I let the word leak, and now look up there on the porch. All I see are people waiting to see the Duke and the Lieutenant. The house is packed to the rafters with hero worshipers.
Looks like a lot of folks.
Oh, there's all kinds of people there. Mostly ladies. There's three high school graduates between 37 and 42, a couple of literary old maids, and one that can write. Two elocutionists are bunking in the corn crib, and I've put cots in the hayloft for the French cook and the society editress of the Chattanooga Opera Glass. You see how names draw, gents.
Then why are you biting your fingernails at all this good luck? You didn't used to be that way.
I ain't normally, but yesterday was the day they was supposed to arrive, and when I goes down to the depot to welcome them, they ain't who they're supposed to be. The mistake was due to my poor eyesight. Instead of being the lieutenant, one was none other than Levi T. Peavy, a soda water clerk from Asheville, and the Duke of Marlborough turned out to be Theo Drake of Murfreesboro, a bookkeeper in a grocery store. What did I do? I kicked them both back on the train and watched them depart for the lowlands, back where they belong.
Sounds like you got a situation on your hands.
You see the fix I'm in, gents. I told the ladies that the notorious visitors had been detained on the road and would arrive in a day or two. When they find out they've been deceived, every one of them will pack up and leave. It's a hard deal.
Friend, have no fear. We have arrived.
Well, can you do it, gents? Can you play the Polar Man and the Little Duke for these nice ladies? Will you do it?
Can we do it? You behold before you, Mr. Smithers, two of the finest equipped men on earth for imitating the proletariat, whether by word of mouth, sleight of hand, or swiftness of foot. Dukes come and go. Explorers go and get lost. But me and Jeff Peters, we keep going after famous folks have come and gone. If you give the word, we'll play the two illustrious guests you were expecting, and you'll find that we'll give you the true local color of the title roles from the Aurora Borealis to the Ducal Portcullis.
Hell, that'd sure save my bacon. And while you're here, the finest offering and furnishings will be all yours. Here, come on up to the porch and let me introduce you around. Ladies, I have the honor to introduce His Gracefulness, the Duke of Marlborough, and the famous inventor of the North Pole, Lieutenant Peary. Here, have a seat, gents, and I'll go fetch a jug of real North Carolina Mountain Dew.
So Andy and I each picked out a rocking chair and began to earn our keep at the Woodchuck Inn with the school marms and literary. But I'd learned to expect trouble when Andy started drinking. Before long, one lady turns to me and says,
"How did that last venture of yours turn out, sir?"
Now, I'd clean forgot to have an understanding with Andy which I was to be, the Duke or the Lieutenant. And I couldn't tell from her question whether she was referring to the Arctic or matrimonial expeditions. So I gave an answer that would cover both bases. "Well, ma'am," says I, "it was a freeze-out. Just a complete freeze-out, ma'am."
"Oh, I see. Yes."
And then the floodgates of Andy's perorations was opened, and I knew which one of the renowned ostensible guests I was supposed to be. Neither. Andy was both. It seemed like he was trying to be the mouthpiece of the whole British nobility and of Arctic exploration all wrapped up into one. It was the union of corn whiskey and the conscientious fictional form used by Mark Twain.
Ladies, I am truly glad to visit America. I do not consider the Magna Charta or gas balloons or snowshoes in any way a detriment to the beauty and charm of your American women, skyscrapers, or the architecture of your icebergs. The next time that I go after the North Pole, all the Vanderbilts in Greenland won't be able to stop me.
Oh, tell us about one of your trips, Lieutenant.
Sure. It was in the spring of last year that I sailed to the castle of Blenheim up to the latitude of 87 degrees Fahrenheit and beat the record. Ladies, it was a sad sight to see a duke allied by a civil and liturgical chateau mortgage to the one of your first families lost in a region of semi-annual days. At four bells, we sighted Westminster Abbey, but there was not a drop to eat. At noon, we threw out five sandbags and the ship rose 15 knots higher. At midnight, all the restaurants closed. Sitting on a cake of ice, we ate seven hot dogs. All around us was snow and ice. Six times a night, the bosun rose up and tore a leaf off the calendar so we could keep time with the barometer. At 12, three huge polar bears sprang down the hatchway into the cabin, and then...
What then, Lieutenant?
The Duchess shook me awake.
At which point, Andy slid out of the chair and began weeping on the porch. Well, of course, that fixed the scheme. The women boarders all packed up and left the next morning. Old Smoke-em-out wouldn't speak to us for 2 days, but when he found out we had money to pay our way, he loosened up. So me and Andy had a quiet, restful summer after all, coming away from Crow Knob with almost $6,000 that we enticed out of old Smoke-em-out playing jacks and marbles. But it didn't take us long to crank our business back up. That fall, we landed in Cairo, Illinois, where we decided to test the exact science of matrimony. Except Andy had some concerns.
I never had much confidence in the perfidiousness of women. As partners or co-educators in the most innocent line of graft, they are not trustworthy.
And he had a point. Take, for example, the little widow lady that we engaged to help us in our matrimonial scheme. We had raised enough advertising capital, thumping old Smoke-em-out at Jack's and Marbles, and so Andy wrote up an advertisement.
Here. How does this sound, Jeff? Charming widow, beautiful, home-loving, 32 years, possessing 3,000 cash, and owning valuable country property, would remarry. Would prefer a poor man with affectionate disposition to one with means, as she realizes that the solid virtues are often to be found in the humble walks of life. No objection to elderly man or one of homely appearance, if faithful and true and competent to manage property and invest money with judgment. Address, with particulars, lonely, care of Peters and Tucker, matrimonial agents, Cairo, Illinois.
So far, so pernicious. And now, where's the lady?
Jeff, I thought you had lost them ideas of realism in your art. Why should there be a lady? Why they sell beef futures on Wall Street, do you expect a stampede? What has a matrimonial ad got to do with a lady?
And we were back to our old wrangling about the ethics of swindling. So I told Andy, you know my rule, that in all my illegitimate activities, the article sold must be existent, visible, and producible. In that way, and by a careful study of city ordinances and train schedules, I have kept out of trouble with the police. Now, to work this scheme, we got to be able to produce bodily a charming widow or its equivalent with or without the beauty, hereditaments, and appurtenances set forth in the advertisement.
Well, maybe it would be safer in case the authorities try to investigate our agency. But where... could you hope to find a widow who would waste time on a matrimonial scheme that has no matrimony in it?
I think I might know just the right party. An old friend of mine, Zeke Trotter, who used to draw soda water and teeth in a tent show, had made his wife a widow a year before by drinking some dyspepsia cure from an old medicine man instead of the liniment that he usually got boozed up on. I stopped at their house often. We might be able to get her to work with us.
Sounds like a good bet, Jeff.
So I went to visit and found her in the same cottage with the same sunflowers and roosters standing around outside. Mrs. Trotter fitted our ad perfectly, except maybe for the age and beauty and property valuation, but she looked feasible and praiseworthy to the eye, and it was a kindness to Zeke's memory to give her the job.
Is this an honest deal you are putting on, Mr. Peters?
Mrs. Trotter, Andy Tucker and me have computed that about 3,000 men in this broad and unfair country will endeavor to secure your fair hand and ostensible money through our advertisement. Out of that number, about 3,000 of them will be lazy and mercenary loafers, swindlers, and contemptible fortune seekers. Me and Andy propose to teach these louts a lesson. Does that satisfy you?
It does, Mr. Peters. I might have known you wouldn't have gone into anything that wasn't upright. But what will my duties be? Do I have to reject personally these 3,000 rapscallions you speak of, or can I throw them out in bunches?
Your only job, Mrs. Trotter, will be to live at a quiet hotel and meet the suitors. Andy and I will attend to all the correspondence and business end of it. Of course, some of the more ardent and impetuous suitors may want to press their suit or whatever fraction of a suit they happen to be wearing. In that case, you may be put to the inconvenience of kicking them out face to face. We'll pay you $25 per week in hotel expenses.
Give me 5 minutes to get my powder case and leave the front door key with a neighbor, and you can let my salary begin.
So I conveyed Mrs. Trotter to a family hotel far enough away from mine and Andy's quarters to be unsuspicious, yet available. And I tell Andy,
great. And now that your conscience is appeased as to the tangibility and proximity of the bait, let's get the ad in the papers and see what kind of fish we might catch.
So we inserted our advertisement in newspapers covering the country far and wide. One ad was all we used because that was all we needed. The responses started pouring in. We put $2,000 in a bank account in Mrs. Trotter's name and gave her the bank book to show in case anybody might question her honesty. I knew Mrs. Trotter was square and reliable, and it was safe to leave it in her name. With that one ad, Andy and me put in 12 hours a day answering letters. About 100 came in every day. Andy said,
I never knew there were so many large-hearted but indigent men in the country who are willing to acquire a charming widow and assume the burden of investing her money.
Most of them admitted that their primary talent was losing jobs, and they were misunderstood by the world. But all of them were sure that they were so chock-full of affection and manly qualities that the widow would be making the bargain of her life to get them. Andy put the bow on the package.
Every applicant will get a reply from Peters and Tucker, informing him that the widow is deeply impressed by his straightforward and interesting letter and requesting them to write again, stating more particulars and enclosing photograph if convenient. We will also inform all applicants that their fee will be $2, cash, and their second letter will not be considered without it.
And there you see the simple beauty of the scheme. About 90% of them raised the entry fee somehow and sent it in. That was all there was to it, except Andy complained a bit.
It is burdensome to slice open all these envelopes and take out the money.
A few clients called in person. We sent them to Mrs. Trotter, and she did the rest, except for three or four who came back to hit us up for train fare. At the height of the scheme, Andy and me were taking in about $200 a day. Toward the end of 3 months, we had taken in over $5,000, and we saw it was time to quit. We had a good many complaints against us, and Mrs. Trotter seemed to be tired of the job. A good many suitors had been making personal visits, and she didn't seem to like that. So we decided to pull out, and I went down to Mrs. Trotter's hotel to pay her last week's salary and to say farewell and to get back our $2,000 in seed capital. When I got there, I found her crying like a kid that don't want to go to school. Now, what's this all about? Did somebody sass you, or are you getting homesick?
No, Mr. Peters, I'll tell you. You was always a friend of Zeke's, and I owe you the truth. Mr. Peters, I'm in love. I just love a man so hard I can't bear not to marry him. He's just the ideal I've always had in mind.
Well, then take him, if the feeling's mutual. Does he return the sentiment according to the specifications and painfulness you have described?
Oh, he does, but he's one of the gentlemen that's been coming to see me about the advertisement, and he won't marry me unless I give him the $2,000. His name is William Wilkinson.
Oh, Mrs. Trotter, there's no man more sympathetic with a woman's affections than I am. Besides, you was once the life partner of one of my best friends. If it was left to me, I'd say take the $2,000 and the man of your choice and be happy. We can afford to do that because we've cleared over $5,000 from these suckers that wanted to marry you. But Andy Tucker has to be consulted. I will talk to Andy and see what I can do.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Peters. I would be eternally grateful.
So I goes back to our hotel and lays the case before Andy.
I was expecting something like this all the time. You can't trust a woman to stick by you in any scheme that involves her emotions and preferences.
It's a sad thing, Andy, to think that we've broken a woman's heart.
It is. And I tell you what I'm willing to do, Jeff. You've always been a man of soft and generous disposition. Perhaps I've been too hard and worldly and suspicious. All right. Go to Mrs. Trotter and tell her to draw the $2,000 from the bank and give it to this man she's infatuated with and be happy.
I jumped up and shook Andy's hand, and then I goes back to Mrs. Trotter and tells her, and she cries as hard for joy as she did for sorrow. 2 days later, me and Andy packed up to go.
All right. I think we're ready to go.
Wouldn't you like to go down and meet Mrs. Trotter once before we leave? She'd like to know you and express her gratitude.
I guess not. We'd better hurry and catch that train.
Well, I was strapping our capital around me in a large money belt like we always carried it when Andy pulls out this huge roll of bills.
Here, put this with the rest.
What's this?
It's Mrs. Trotter's $2,000.
How'd you get it?
She gave it to me. I've been calling on her 3 evenings a week for more than a month.
I don't get it. You mean...
Yep. Stick out your hand and meet Mr. William Wilkinson.
And with that, we leave Jeff Peters and Andy Tucker as they make their way on to the next town, working on a new swindle as they go. We hope you've enjoyed this presentation of stories from O. Henry's book, The Gentle Grafter, adapted for radio by Brad Buchanan. Our performers for this show were Brad Buchanan as Jeff Peters, Carrie Butters as Andy Tucker, Darren Helwidge as Murkison and Smoke 'Em Out, and Dana Naylor was the lady on the porch and Mrs. Trotter. Darren Helwidge was the sound engineer, and we hope you've enjoyed this presentation by the Maplewood Barn Radio Players. This is your narrator, Byron Scott, hoping you'll join us again next week for another classic story, right here on KBIA.